Welcome to Sunstone Session 163. My name is Jake Zollinger. I'm the chair for this session. I will briefly introduce Michael Marquardt, and then we will have him read his paper for approximately 40 to 45 minutes. And there is no respondent to his paper, but we will have then questions and answers. If you do want to ask a question, you'll either have to come to the mic or you'll have to ask Michael to repeat the question because it won't transcribe to the tape if we don't. Okay, H. Michael Marquardt is married and has five children. He lives in Sandy, Utah. He has a bachelor's degree from the College of Eastern Utah. He belongs to a number of historical associations. He has published 23 to 25 articles that I have here. There are too many to recite. And two major books, Inventing Mormonism, which he co-authored with the late Wesley Walters, and Joseph Smith, Revelations, Text, and Commentary. A very knowledgeable historian and a reputation of fine scholarly research. So I'll turn the time over to Michael and we'll proceed from there.
This paper will explore what is known about Martin Harris and his relationships to Restoration churches under the leadership of James J. Strang, William E. McLellan, Gladden Bishop, and so forth. It is a brief summary of his activities in Kirkland from 1851 to 1870. As a background, Martin Harris was born on May 18, 1783, and became a farmer who owned valuable property in Palmyra Township, New York. Harris, at the age of 26, married his cousin, Lucy, 9 years her senior. He was a family man, raising a family of four known children. Harris stated that in 1818, he was inspired of the Lord and taught of the Spirit that he should not join any church. He was trusted in ordinary day-to-day business dealings, but was considered by his contemporaries in religious matters as a visionary man and easily influenced. One of the reasons that you do not hear more about Martin in his Kirkland years is because he was an unstable man in religious matters. Martin Harris became the last of the three witnesses to see in vision the Book of Mormon gold plates and add his name to the religious testimony of his authenticity. He is known for financing the publication of the Book of Mormon. His marriage with his wife, Lucy, broke up because of the time and money he spent promoting Joseph Smith Jr. and the Book of Mormon. He was 46 years old when he was baptized into the Restored Church on April 6, 1830, the day of organization. The first contemporary reference to Martin Harris being in Ohio is when he arrived at Painesville on March 12, 1831. The local newspaper reported that he immediately planted himself in the bar room of the hotel. He told all about the gold plates, angels and spirits, and Joe Smith. He had seen and handled them all by the power of God. He was very flippant, talking fast and loud in order that others could not interpose an opinion counter to his. Every idea he advanced, he knew to be absolutely true, as he said, by the Spirit and power of God, declaring that all who believed the new Bible would see Christ within 15 years, and all who did not would absolutely be destroyed and damned. Martin visited Kirkland for a number of days and then returned to Palmyra. On his second trip from Palmyra, he led a group of saints to Kirkland. Martin was a member of the United Firm by June 12, 1833. On this day, he signed a letter with the church presidency addressed to Edward Partridge relating to the city center of Zion and the temples that would be built there. Later that year in December, while Martin was at Ira Ames' home, we were impressed to get up and go to Joseph's house. On reaching his house, we found Joseph and Oliver Cowdery at breakfast. Oliver said to us, "Good morning, brethren. We have just received news from heaven," and pointed to some sheets of paper lying on the table. They had been up all night receiving and writing the revelation, and Emma had just got breakfast for them. It was a revelation given in December 1833. Martin took it up and read it to us. Later, in February 1834, Joseph Smith organized the church's Kirkland High Council. Harris was chosen a member. Martin attended some meetings, but he was often out of town, as he made frequent trips to Palmyra. In 1835, he assisted in a selection of the first 12 apostles, ordaining 9 apostles. Harris left Kirkland as he was not at the meeting of February 21st when Parry P. Pratt was ordained an apostle. Pratt received his ordination from Joseph Smith Jr., Oliver Cowdery, and David Whitmer. Jonathan Hale, Thomas B. Marsh, and David W. Patton went to Palmyra to the home of Elder Martin Harris, thence to the Hill Cumorah, and went on the hill and offered up our thanks to the Most High God for the record of the Nephites and other blessings. Then went about from house to house to inquire the character of Joseph Smith in previous to receiving the Book of the Plates of Mormon. The answer was that his character was as good as young men in general. This was on the 30th day of May, 1835. Harris was still in Palmyra in July when Edward Partridge lodged with Brother Martin Harris. Soon after, Martin returned to Kirkland and received his patriarchal blessing from under the hand of Joseph Smith Sr., Church Patriarch, on August 27th, 1835. The blessing stated, "Thou hast left thy family and house for the gospel's sake, and given all for the purpose of spreading the work of thy God, for thou shalt be blessed and rewarded an hundredfold. Yea, thou hast left thy family and consecrated them unto the Lord." He also was told, "If thou desirest with all thy heart and art faithful, thou shalt yet teach them, even thy wife, that she may be saved in the day of eternity. But if not, they shall be removed from the earth, and their place be supplied with another. And thy heart shall be satisfied, for thou shalt raise up seed unto the Lord to praise him in his kingdom." Harris returned to Palmyra and sold property on October 13, 1835, signed with Lucy Harris. Though separated in their marriage, they still managed to sell property for revenue. It was recorded in Joseph Smith's journal that Elder Martin Harris also returned this morning, December 14, 1835, from Palmyra, New York. Harris had no known involvement in the purchase of the Egyptian mummies and papyri, the Hebrew school, or the Kirkland Safety Bank. Family tradition has it that Martin's wife, Lucy, died in Palmyra in the summer of 1836 at the age of 44. On November 1st, 1834, Martin married Caroline Young. She was the daughter of John Young, brother of Brigham Young. Caroline was 20 years old when she married Harris, and Martin was 33 years older than Caroline. Harris was 53 years old. Brigham Young's history states that in March 1837, he traveled as far as Canandaigua, New York, where we stopped 2 nights in 1 day. While I was there, I visited Martin Harris. And Martin was there at Palmyra as he sold property on May 6, 1837, with his wife, Caroline. In 1837, Martin, along with other members, had a falling out with church officials. Near the end of December, he was cut off from the church by the High Council. While Harris had no stock in the Kirkland Bank, he may have been influenced by its failure. John A. Clark, a Palmyra acquaintance of Martin, wrote concerning the Kirkland Bank enterprise. Ultimately, this speculation contributed to sever Martin from Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon. Harris, in one of his late visits to Palmyra, remarked to a friend of mine that Joe Smith had now become a complete wretch and that he had no confidence in either him or Rigdon. In January 1838, he was associated with the major leader of the dissenters, Warren Parrish. Harris helped incorporate the Church of Christ and was one of the three trustees along with Joseph Cole and Cyrus Smalling. Though many individuals had problems with Joseph Smith, they still worshipped in the Kirkland Temple. Caroline and Martin's first child was born in January. Their family eventually included seven children. By 1840, Martin was received back into the church. 2 years later, after a religious reformation in November 1842, he was rebaptized, as were other dissenters. Four separate sources state that soon after this, Martin became a follower of Mother Ann Lee, founder in the 18th century of the Shaker movement, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. Harris apparently associated with a divine roll or book published in New Hampshire in 1843. The book was titled A Holy, Sacred, and Divine Rolling Book from the Lord God of Heaven to the Inhabitants of Earth, revealed in the United States at New Lebanon, County of Columbia, State of New York, United States of America. 500 copies of the book were bound and printed in September 1843. At that time, most Shakers believed in receiving messages from the spirit world besides obtaining instruction from Mother Ann Lee. Communications in this sacred book include both a holy roll written by John the Revelator, and revelations from biblical personages such as Elisha, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Malachi, Micah, Noah, and Peter. The publication also included many testimonies about visitation of angels, showing them the rolling book. Myra Bean stated, "Thus, having received much precious knowledge at different times, I have not the least reason to doubt the divine origin of this sacred rolling book, but affirm it to be true and unadulterable word of our Heavenly Father, sent forth upon the earth by no other means than that of divine inspiration." Other experiences, such as those at North Union, Ohio, included communications from the spirit world and were taken from the mouths of inspired instruments, copied verbatim, and they went into vision and read as they were inspired to read from a roll, manuscript, or letter, which to us were invisible until revealed. One such revealment came as a letter from Father Abraham, written by his own hand in vision with Holy Mother Wisdom, which was Mother Mary Ann Lee. Spiritual manifestations included those in the Shaker book moved Harris in a special way. Clark Braden, in a debate held in 1884 in Kirkland, mentioned that Harris declared repeatedly that he had as much evidence for a Shaker book as he had for the Book of Mormon. By the end of 1844, Martin Harris believed in and had a strong testimony of this sacred roll. In 1846, Martin Harris accepted James J. Strang as prophet and successor to Joseph Smith. At a conference at the Kirkland Temple, Harris became a member of Strang's High Council, as was his brother Preserved and William Cowdery, Oliver Cowdery's father. Lester Brooks and Martin Harris were among those chosen to go on a church mission to England. Harris was planning on being away from Kirkland for at least a year. The group arrived in England in October 1846, but there was opposition from the Latter-day Saints Millennial Star. Not having an opportunity to speak at a church conference in Birmingham, he went into the street and proclaimed the corruption of the Nauvoo 12 Apostles. Later, Harris publicly denied being sent by Strang or being in any way connected with him. They did not have any success in their missionary work during the 2.5 months there. In fact, it was one of the shortest missions to England. Harris and Brooks arrived back in New York on December 8th. Returning to Kirkland by January 1847, Martin joined former apostle William E. McClellan's Church of Christ, which was advocating David Whitmer as prophet, seer, revelator, and succession to Joseph Smith. William E. McClellan received a revelation given the following instructions. "Yea, let my servant William McClellan baptize and confirm and then reordain my servant Martin Harris, and thus shall be confirmed his authority by the laying out of hands, in saying, Brother Martin, I lay my hands upon you in the name of Jesus Christ, and I reordain you and confirm upon you the office of high priest in the Church of Christ, after the holy order of the Son of God. And I pray God, in the name of Jesus, his Son, to give unto you, in your calling, all the gifts and blessings and power thereof, and keep you faithful unto the end. Amen. And let my servant Martin administer unto my servant William McClellan in the same manner and according to the same pattern. And then let my servant Leonard Rich likewise receive the same ministration. Yea, let my servants William and Martin and Leonard do as the Spirit of Truth now directs them." On February 13, 1847, Harris joins William E. McClellan's Church of Christ by baptism, confirmation, and reordination to the same authority which we held in the church before Latter-day Saintism was known. This church numbered about 42 members. A committee wrote, "Martin Harris has retired to his little farm in Kirkland, Ohio, and stands warning all that the church will not prosper until they throw away their fictitious name and take again the name, as in the beginning, the name of the Church of Christ and return to their first love and then keep the commandments of God." Lester Brooks wrote to James J. Strang, "Martin Harris is, I learn, at Kirkland doing all he can against you. The greatest blunder that I ever committed was in taking Harris to England." Harris was so impressed with this organization that he gave his testimony as the one of three witnesses that Joseph Smith, in July 1834, ordained David Whitmer as his successor. Harris retired to his farm. At a church conference in June of 1849, Martin Harris was appointed president of the meeting, and it was resolved that fellowship be withdrawn from William McClellan, both as an elder or member of the church. In November 1849, Harris was in Rochester, New York. A local newspaper reported that he no longer goes with the Mormons and bore his testimony against them. Harris professed to have a mission from God. In 1851, Harris became a follower of Francis Gladden Bishop. Bishop claimed to have the sacred things, that is, the golden plates of the Book of Mormon, the Book of Ether, the Book of Life, which is a sealed record, the interpreters, the breastplate of Moroni, and the sword of Laban. A detailed description of each was given by Bishop in the Kirkland Temple in March 1851. Bishop's description was published in a broadside titled, A Proclamation from the Lord to His People Scattered Throughout All the Earth. And he gives one of the most detailed description of the gold plates in all Mormonism. The plates are pure gold, about 8 inches in length and about 6 inches in width, and in compact form, about 4 inches in thickness, each plate being about the 1/12 of an inch thick. They are in all 48 plates, divided as follows. The first part, or division, consisting of 24 plates, from these was the Book of Mormon translated. And on the first plate of this division is inscribed in large Reform Egyptian the title of this division, which in the English language is rendered the Book of Mormon. There are also a variety of other characters upon the same page, among which are the characters which stand as an alphabet of the Reformed Egyptian language in which this whole division is written. The characters are rubbed over with a black substance so as to fill them up in order that the dazzling of the gold between the characters would not prevent them from being readily seen. This proclamation by Gladden Bishop was the flying roll sent forth by the Lord as the testimony and power of my three witnesses whom I have now called. The three witnesses were Gladden Bishop, Bishop's wife Phoebe, and Martin Harris. Bishop stated, "My witnesses have borne their testimony before my people in this place, yea, and in my house, even that which my people have built and dedicated unto me in Kirkland." Stephen Hart said that Harris worked off and on for him for 15 or 20 years. His judgment about farming was good. When we finished hoeing the corn, he would raise his hands toward the field and pronounce a blessing and say he was sure of a good crop with his blessing. Martin, when closely questioned about the plates from which the Book of Mormon purports to have been taken, would say that he saw the plates by the eye of faith. By 1855, Martin was a spiritualist. He visited Miss Sexton, a spirit medium of Cleveland, Ohio, and received through her a proclamation. This he published in May 1855 as a proclamation and warning voice unto all people, first to the kings, governors, and rulers in authority, and unto every kindred, tongue, and people under the whole heavens. The 8-page pamphlet proclaimed the word of the Lord from Moses, Elias, Elijah, and John. Martin was called the messenger of the covenant, for he spake the words of Elijah and was sent forth to do the work of Elijah. Christopher Carey recalled the following about Harris. "One day when working for me, he handed me a leaflet that he had got printed, taken from some of the prophets, telling of a wonderful person that should appear, drawing all men after him. I looked it over and returned it to him. He, Martin, said, 'Who do you think it refers to?' I said, 'Why, of course, it refers to you.' he looked very much pleased and said, "I see you understand the scriptures." Stephen Post was personally involved in a conference held in the Kirkland Temple with Martin Harris as the conference president and Post as secretary. 12 resolutions were accepted and plans for another conference the next year. Martin wrote a letter to Brigham Young, sending him a copy of the proclamation and commanding him in the name of God to publish the revelation in the Deseret News or another publication. Brigham Young did not have the proclamation printed. Martin's wife, Caroline, was pregnant with her 7th child about August 1855. Martin was 72 years old and Caroline was 39. She and their family are listed in the 1856 Iowa Census for Rockford Township, Pottawatomie County, Iowa. Martin is listed apparently as Martinance, 73 years old, in the census record. It is not known when Caroline left Kirkland, nor is it certain that Martin was in Iowa. Their daughter Ida Mae was born on May 27, 1856. The Harris family is listed near the Littlefield family that include Lyman and his wife Louisa. Louisa was Caroline's sister and may have influenced her to leave Kirkland and gather to Utah Territory. Travelers through Kirkland in 1858 reported the activity of Martin Harris and William Smith. John Clinton said that they had organized a church of their own. Enoch Beese reported that William Smith had been appointed prophet, seer, and revelator. And after a few days, Harris drove William Smith out of the place and damned him to hell. In early 1859, editor Joel Tiffany of Tiffany's Monthly, a spiritualist publication of New York City, visited Martin Harris. Martin's account is an important recollection of events that he was associated with in Palmyra and Manchester, New York, prior to 1828. Harris told Tiffany that he asked members of the Joseph Smith Sr. family how the plates were found and was told that they were located through the medium of a stone. In 1860, Martin is listed in the census as living with his and Lucy's son, George. Harris is listed as a Mormon preacher. According to recollection of Francis M. Lyman, Harris was showing visitors through the Kirkland Temple. William W. Blair, an apostle in the reorganization, proceeded to Kirkland, arriving there on August 9th. Blair recalled that he met James Twist and family, Martin Harris, Leonard Rich, and others. Blair recalled in his memoirs, "On Sunday, the 19th of August, Brother James Blakely and I attended a meeting in the temple where Simon Atwood of Erie, Pennsylvania, and Leonard Rich of Kirkland were the speakers. By their request, Elder Blakely and myself took seats in the stand with them and Martin Harris." Simon Atwood was an elder in the LDS Church. Blair remembered that at this meeting, a long-haired stranger sprang to his feet, uttered an unearthly yell, hissed, stamped his feet, shook his head, and looked like the embodiment of evil. Mr. Rich at once dropped into his seat, and the stranger sprang upon the partition between their seats, came to the front, facing the stand, stamping, hissing, and making other violent demonstrations. Martin Harris, who sat on my left, whispered to me, "I guess he has got the devil on him." Blair continued, "The stranger sprang squarely upon the speaker's desk, Harris, Rich, and Atwood leaving it with haste. And with another spring, he reached the second stand, and with another the third stand, and with still another the fourth and highest stand, this being the Melchizedek priesthood side of the temple. On reaching this high point, he turned and faced the frightened, fleeing congregation, and stripping off his broadcloth cloth coat, tearing it in strips and shreds, he again stamped, hissed, and shook his head. swinging his torn coat and shouting to the people repeatedly, "Now is come the time of your trial." The man then sprang upon the four stands of the Aaronic priesthood side of the temple. William Blair saw the stranger, his ragged coat rolled up and tucked under his arm, striding down the steps and then down the street in an excited way, after which we saw him no more. Upon inquiring, we learned that he was a prominent spiritual medium, resided in New York, and his name was Van Dusen, that is, Increase Van Dusen. In February 1862, James McKnight visited Harris. He wrote, Harris says he is going to Utah as soon as the Lord will release him. Eight years later, Edward Stevenson, on a mission for the LDS Church, visited Kirkland to see the temple. Stevenson wrote concerning this visit, "While there in Kirkland, I again met Martin Harris soon after coming out of the temple. He took from under his arm a copy of the Book of Mormon, the first edition, I believe, and bore a faithful testimony. And he said that it was his duty to continue to lift up his voice as he has been commanded to do in defense of the book that he held in his hand, and offered to prove from the Bible that just such a book was to come forth out of the ground. And that too in a day when there were no prophets on the earth, and that was daily bearing testimony to many who visited the temple." And Stevenson actually gave Harris his testimony and went to Utah, and he wrote to Martin Harris and received a reply from Harris that the Spirit of God for the first time prompted him to go to Utah. Brigham Young requested Stevenson to get up a subscription and immigrate Martin. $200 was raised, and Stevenson eventually returned to Kirkland. Edward Stevenson mentioned that Martin had a great desire to see Utah and his children that lived there, and that Harris was coming to the conclusion, after trying everything else, that the work of the Lord was progressing in the top of the mountains, and that the people are gathering in fulfillment of prophecy. Harris and Stevenson left Kirkland on August 19, 1870. They arrived 10 days later in Ogden, Utah. Martin Harris spent the remaining 4.5 years of his life in Cache Valley and died in Clarkson on July 10, 1875 at the age of 92. Martin Harris followed and was associated with a number of churches throughout the Kirkland years. He always maintained a belief in the organizations he joined. It appears that Harris was unstable in his religious ideals. He was influenced by Warren Parrish, William E. McClellan, and others. Harris accepted a number of prophetic leaders after the death of Joseph Smith, and like many other spiritual gypsies, he wanted a place where he would be important. Martin followed or believed in James J. Strang, David Whitmer, Gladden Bishop, and William Smith as prophets, seers, and revelators. In all of these religious movements, he never denied any of his experiences. Hopefully, additional research will broaden our understanding of Martin Harris's Kirkland years. Thank you.
We have a whole 25 minutes. I'll ask the first question, and then you can either come to the pulpit and ask your question, or I'll ask Mike to repeat it so that it'll record. My question, Mike, is for a Mormon believer, given the fact that Martin Harris was apparently so unstable and maybe even flaky in his subsequent life, would this not add weighted emphasis to his testimony of the Book of Mormon, because otherwise, why, when he was so mad at Brigham Young and Mormonism, would he not have denied his testimony of the Book of Mormon if he had been a faker?
Well, basically, Martin was just very easily influenced. I didn't have time to do it, but prior to being baptized in 1830, even though he didn't join any church in the Palmyra area, at various times he was associated with ideas in Quaker, Universalist, Restoration, Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian. He was very interested in religion. Some references mention that he really knew his Bible well. I think that really he was just easily influenced in religious matters. It appears that his business matters, everyone agrees that he was, they had no problem with his business activities, with his farm. I think the main thing is how to influence him, and he had a lot of property, which basically equals money. And so he was the one that Joseph Smith looked to help finance the Book of Mormon through his the mortgage of his farm. Yes, Mel.
Mike, can you comment about the experience of Martin Harris taking the characters who represent them? How relevant is the account?
Okay, the question I'm repeating is relating to Martin Harris's trip to Professor Charles Anthon in New York City. Well, it appears that the account that we normally hear about is probably, I think, fairly accurate. New newspaper articles in the 1830s say that Anthon identified some of those characters from, I guess, his own readings. Lucy Smith, in her preliminary manuscript, mentioned the alphabet that was to be transcribed. And, of course, this was supposed to be one of the items that Martin took to Charles Anthon. So it's just an interesting item. That's not in the actual published 1853 version of Lucy's history. But you also may see it may tie into some ideas that Gladden Bishop mentioned that on the first plate was an alphabet. So maybe in that case in 1851, who influenced who? Did Bishop get information from Martin? Because Bishop was claiming a lot of things, that he received a vision from Nephi, the same one who appeared to Joseph Smith. And that he received the plates and the sword and the sealed record and everything. So he was probably in good company at that particular time. Thank you. Yes?
Did Martin Harris not go to Nauvoo at all? Did he stay in Kirkland?
Martin Harris, the question is whether Martin Harris went to Nauvoo or whether he remained in Kirkland. Basically, he settled in Kirkland, Ohio. He still went to Palmyra to sell property that he had there. In fact, one time, I think it was 1841, there was a notice of the death of Martin Harris. And, of course, I guess a lot of people thought that he died. But he was alive and well, and that's where he said he had a special mission from God. He was very much against, I guess you'd say, some of the theological changes and what he perceived to be errors during the Kirkland period. Yes? The question was whether Lucy Smith could be referring to the grammar that Joseph Smith had in 1835. No, not in this instance, because the context was approximately 1827, 1828. But Well, basically, the idea was before you translate, you have an alphabet. And so the alphabet that was in Kirkland was, of course, done before actually doing the so-called translation. Yes?
Do these artifacts of Latin bishops verify or differ with anybody else?
The question is about the artifacts that Gladden Bishop have, whether they vary from other descriptions. Basically, they're not too far off. I mean, each description of how big the plates are in inches, they usually vary 1 or 2 inches anyway. But I think that it's very probable that the bishop just got the information from Martin Harris, because Bishop claimed that the angel who appeared to him also showed him the 116 pages. Yes, Jess?
Could you say more, Mike, about the relationship Martin had with his wife? She was absolutely a shrew and put all sorts of pressure on Joseph and him. It's a much larger story, this whole 116-page situation. And she really got Joseph very anxious and very nervous, and I think he didn't function very well. And Martin seemed to be very much under her influence. But anyway, say more about whatever happened in that marriage. It was really a very interesting
fact. Yes, well, the question was relating to Lucy Harris and his her relationship to Joe Smith and maybe the 116 pages. Basically, remember that Martin Harris was the scribe for the 116 pages. Of all persons, he was the one that knew the content of those pages. And when he took those home and read them to his family, just so I could reinforce it, what he said, in 1860, when W.W. Blair was in Kirkland, he talked to Martin, and Martin was still feeling pretty bad about the loss of the pages at that time. But Lucy Harris, Martin's wife, it's really hard to say what her motivation was, except that she didn't want any property going out of their hands. So as far as we know, there first there was no known divorce between Martin Harris and Lucy Harris. We know that they actually sold property together after their separation. So during these times when Martin was in Kirkland, well, he would leave and go to Palmyra, sell some more property, probably split some money with Lucy, because her signature, of course, would be on the property, too. After Martin Harris first heard about the golden plates, he had his wife, Lucy, and his daughter, Lucy, go down to the Smith Frame House in Manchester and talk to the family. And when they came back, Martin, in his interview with Joel Tiffany, box. So I think that Lucy Harris was very concerned, probably as soon as they copied the characters, because in Lucy Smith's history, she mentioned she was trying to convince Martin to get out of the whole thing. Yes, Bill?
My question is more for Jess. Why would Lucy be a shrew? Wouldn't 99 out of 100 of the wives be gravely concerned about the other Martin in the farm or something?
Well, that's a little judgmental of me, but actually, though, if you read Lucy Smith's manuscript, it's really startling. What Lucy Harris did is she tried to cajole Joseph, tried to say, "Well, just show me, and then I'll support you." Then she would call him a fraud, and she had a dream in which he should show her the manuscript. She tried to force her way down with Martin. I mean, she was very, very intrusive. Lucy was very biased towards her.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have any other questions? Yes, sir.
There have been all kinds of churches of Christ that we were one of. And after you mentioned that Martin Harris, you mentioned associating with two different ones in your report. The first was in 1838, and I'm wondering if that church was the Church of Christ, which we know today, founded by Alexander Campbell, and Sidney Richard was one of his associates. Was this that Church of Christ? I wasn't sure that you made that clear.
Thank you. Actually, Martin was involved in three Churches of Christ. The first one was the April 6, 1830, the official name, Church of Christ. The second one was in January 1838, that I'll mention in a moment. And the third one was with William E. McClellan. And there may even be more because he was involved in Kirkland when some of the groups were fixing up the Kirkland Temple. And they were changing the name of the temple on the outside. The one in January 1838, that was one of the dissenters' Church of Christ. They basically followed the law of Ohio, posted the notice of invasion. And Sylvester Smith was a clerk. Warren A. Cottery was a justice of the peace. And this was the group that separated from the main body of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, which was the name was changed in May of 1834. See, that was the church that was established in Fayette, whereas the Church of Christ, April 6, 1830, was, of course, organized in Manchester, Ontario County, New York. Right after this, in March, there was a conflict within this dissenting group relating to the Book of Mormon. So like a little mini Sunstone debate on the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. And in a letter of Stephen Barnett, he mentions the debate that was had where Martin Harris stated in public that he never saw the place with his natural eyes, only in vision or imagination, neither Oliver nor David. And also that the eight witnesses never saw them and hesitated to sign that instrument for that reason, but were persuaded to do it. And then he was followed by Warren Parrish, Luke Johnson, and John Boynton, who concurred with me. Now remember, Warren Parrish was one of the 70s, Luke Johnson was an apostle. He eventually came back into the church, and John Boynton was an apostle. So they agreed, and it says, Martin Harris got up. It says, Martin Harris arose and said he was sorry for any man who rejected the Book of Mormon, for he knew it was true. He said he hefted the place repeatedly in a box with only a tablecloth or handkerchief over them. But he never saw them, only as he saw a city through a mountain, and that he never should have told that the testimony of the eight was false. So here, in the Kirkland Temple, he says, I therefore 3 weeks since, in the stone chapel, that's the Kirkland Temple, it was used by many of the Restoration churches. It is used today as a public worship by many of the Restoration churches, including the Restoration branches, including the Church of Jesus Christ, the William Bickerton group. So there's a lot of Churches of Christ. I may read another comment he said relating to the Latter-day Saint term later. Do we have any other comments? Yes. Well, I think that he was a religious seeker, but he did have some mental problems religiously. It seemed that he just about followed anyone who had a special claim, whether it was some plates. It wasn't just Joseph Smith. It was James Strang who claimed to have gold plates. You have Gladden Bishop, who said he had every item there was, all the sacred instruments. In the case of the Shakers, it was probably not that he was going to be believing that because he was married, had children and everything, but he was very impressed with that special role and the testimony So he was very religious. He knew his Bible. So I think, yes, he was had a problem. One of the persons interviewed in Kirkland commented that person thought that he was just insane about Mormonism. So each people may have a different view as they knew him. Yes. Okay, the question was relating to, did Martin Harris ever reveal the content of the 116 pages that were lost? No, as far as we know, he didn't. The closest is the recollections of and claims of Gladden Bishop, who claimed that he was given those by the angel Nephi, and that they had more of a bluish type paper, which is, of course, I think, questionable. As far as we know, probably no one ever asked. Yes.
How did he support himself during those years before his family and the Brigham Young and the people brought him out to Utah? How did he support himself?
The question was relating to how Martin Harris supported himself. Well, in the early years, of course, he had land in Palmyra, and he just go there periodically. It's right in the deed books, and sell the property.
But he was apparently pretty broke. They had to take a collection to go and get him.
Yes, well, in the 1860 census, if I'm not mistaken, he was living with his son, with his first wife, Lucy. George B. Harris in Kirkland, but he died soon after. As far as problems within a family dynamics, I think there is more to be done relating to the Harris family, not only because of Martin's wife Lucy, but George, his son, was having evidently the same problems. George would have beat his wife. The marriage practices within the Harris family of Martin marrying his cousin and of others, I don't have a lot of the genealogical information on that, but I've been told that there's a very close intermarriage within the family. And I know there's one newspaper article I saw at the Western Reserve Historical Society that mentions about his George Harris. He was in the clink because he basically just beat on his wife. Maybe any other questions? One more.
Are there any instances that you know of where Martin Harris said that he actually handled the plates other than kept them in the plot, where he actually saw them, turned the pages?
Yes, Martin said that he handled them. In that particular religious testimony, it just mentions the angel. And so, but in his actually a number of places, he does say he handled them, and he doesn't give any qualifications on that. I think it was about 1862, or well, it could have been even earlier, that one of the missionaries visited Kirkland and talked to Harris, and Harris said, yeah, he saw and handled them. Well, no one really knows, but one thing Martin did say throughout his life is that he saw the plates by the eye of faith, and that is exactly what Section 17 of the Doctrine and Covenants says. That section was not in the Book of Commandment manuscript revelations. That was till it was not published in the Book of Commandments. Here's one quote from the Rochester newspaper in 1849. It says, about Harris, he no longer goes with the Mormons, saying that they have gone to the devil just as other people.
He had banned them 15 years ago when they assumed the application of Latter-day Saints and bore his testimony against them by declaring that Latter-day Devils would be more appropriate designation. It's more than, even when he was interviewed by Joel Tiffany, he said the same thing. It doesn't seem like he denied any of his experiences, but he was easily persuaded. So if someone came around to be a prophet, I mean, imagine William Smith coming around, it depends upon his what he's believing at the time, trying to organize a church. And then a few days later, Harris just tells him, rejects him and tells him to go to hell. There's other groups there at Kirkland, too, but I think what we can find out is that this is almost like sort of the beginning of trying to put together one man's view, and he happened to be one of the witnesses. He happened to be, at the early period of time, an important leader, and yet he was easily influenced. And when you add on other people who would, follow Strang, I guess I'll stop right here. Example, the Hiram Page, who was one of the eight, and the Whitmers. John Whitmer was one of the eight. There's David Whitmer, one of the three. The Jacob Whitmer, one of the eight. When they got one of the reprints of one of the first newspaper's little pamphlet that James Strang put out in 1846, without even Strang visiting them, so they just had an account of Strang founding some plates, they accepted him as the successor. So they believed that he was the successor of Joseph Smith. John Whitmer wrote in his own history that fact. And then when William McClellan was trying to get David to be the successor, it's almost like, after all these years, did they forget? Did they forget that Joseph Smith actually ordained him in 1834? What were they doing all in between this time? All of a sudden, it just like pops in their minds. Oh, yeah, Joseph ordained him. See, Martin Harris put his name to the testimony of three witnesses relating to that ordination. And it's this point where you find, the Whitmers are easily influenced. Oliver Cowdery, easily influenced, because when William McClellan visited him, he wrote a letter to David Whitmer saying that, yes, we have the keys. And of course, Cowdery is influenced again. So, just depends. Some people move really fast between different organizations, different prophets and prophetic leaders. Others are basically more stable, even though doctrine or organization or other things they don't agree with have changed and developed. They still, go with the majority of the people. Well, I hope you've learned a few items relating to Harris, and I didn't have too much time on the New York period because I was trying to concentrate on the longer time frame when Harris was living in Kirkland, and after the Saints, most of them left. Not there was always some Saints there from different varieties. They always came through. They always wanted to get possession of the Kirkland Temple. But the thing is that research into these areas is very open. There's probably a lot more stuff to check out. And so I enjoy presenting this paper, and I hope you have a good time at Sunstone. Thank you.
Excellent job. I had one more question.